Good morning. Since the 9/11 attacks, you know life in the U.S. has dramatically changed. With the 15th anniversary in a few weeks, contributing editor Neil Milner looks at a year-long study and some criticism about whether we're actually safer. Meanwhile, in Hawaii, Mothers Against Drunk Driving is already at work on its 2017 legislative agenda. Longtime backbone of the group, Carol McNamee, gives us a peek at how it furthers the national five-year agenda. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Art Harris and his fellow members of Team Chucky have found a way to put all that useless information stored in their brains to work as winners of the Oahu Island Trivia Tournament of Champions. And Gary Paul Nabon is an ethnobiologist determined to bridge the worlds of Western science and indigenous knowledge. He's coming to Maui for a talk at the Merwin Conservancy.
It's Wednesday, August 24th. That's The Conversation. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday. You're listening to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and you, sir, as always, are Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, I think all of us knew on 9/11 that our world was changing forever.
I think by the 12th, we were starting to get that idea.
Yeah.
But it really began to come out in ensuing weeks. But how the world has changed and what kind of narrative we now hear about those changes is the subject of our first conversation this morning. Now, in a few weeks, the U.S. will mark the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. After all the changes those years have brought, the issues we continue to grapple with are whether we're now better able to understand how to fight and how to face terrorism. An article in the September issue of The Atlantic magazine is based on a year-long study, and in it, writer Stephen Brill asks a basic question. Are we safer? Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now with a look at Brill's position and a couple of responses to it. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk about what did Stephen Brill find after looking at this year-long study?
Well, he found a lot of things. He found, first of all, there is some good news. How much terrorism we've stopped is very hard to discover. But some of the good news is that our intelligence operation is much more consolidated than it was before some of the intelligence gathering operations, particularly the NYPD, are good. There are certain kinds of pamphlets and materials that are out there. We have in place a reasonably good TSA for checking airplanes, so that we are certainly much more organized around certain things than we were before. The bad news, first of all, there's conventional bad news. Not surprisingly, a lot of money was wasted. There was a sudden urge to spend a lot of money to fix this problem, and as soon as you do that, you open up yourself for all kinds of possibilities of waste and so on. And some of the big ones, for example, $47 billion of money to develop a kind of communication system between first responders that probably wasn't necessary, going down the tubes. So that's examples of good and bad news. What's really important is what I call complicated news, which is about the fact that the nature of terrorism has changed, and slowly that has led to a kind of reemphasis on how to approach this.
When we came through 9/11, those first weeks, there seemed to be the idea that we would be able to surmount it, that we were going to be able to get through it, and then we were going to stop this, you know, stop it from ever happening again. But that narrative has been changing over all of these years. And now the idea seems to be that we need to know how to manage it. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think that's one way of saying it. The important word is resiliency, and our movement toward resiliency has been kind of gradual, sort of reluctant, and so on. The initial response from 9/11, and to some extent still now, is that we have to go on with our lives, but we can do things to mitigate this. We can do things to stop terrorism. And much of our operation is set up with the idea that you can stop terrorism. what's begun to happen, particularly as the nature of terror has changed, when we've moved into people, as one person described it, you're looking for one guy in the basement who can be influenced, build a, and carry out his own terror attack without any kind of coordination from anybody else. That's begun to change the focus. And what one of the writers, Catherine Mongu Ward, says is that really what Brill documented is what it's like fighting the last war, because this kind of thing against terrorism is very different. And that's where the idea of resiliency starts coming in. World leaders like Obama and Hollande in France have begun to try to move people into thinking more about what resilience means.
Angela Merkel, too. But yes, as we look at this idea of resiliency, there's a lot of pushback to that, particularly from a certain sector that wants to be able to create a walled-off America, sort of, you know, this island of goodness that nothing else can touch, because everything we do to be able to keep ourselves safe is working so well, or can work so well. That seems to be a bit of a fantasy.
Well, it's a bit of a fantasy, but it's to some extent an understandable one. Let's go back to look quickly at what resiliency means. Resiliency is based on the notion that you simply cannot stop all terror, that terrorist attacks are going to be a part of American life for an indefinite period. And as horrible as they are, and this is also important, they're not an existential threat. They're horrible, but they're not an existential threat. So what you begin to do is to focus on things like quick recovery, like training first aid, first responders to have more coordination, that what you're trying to do is to bring people back from these things as fast as possible and to get over the fact that you can stop all terror and that you have to spend that terror money, anti-terror money, always gets first priority. There are two problems. There are two challenges to that idea. One challenge is psychological. People, a narrative, a story of somebody in pain, a horrible event, drives people's fears and it makes them overemphasize risk. The second one is political. You're living in a world right now in America, and Donald Trump is a good example, where people are trying, where he is trying to mobilize folks with a fair amount of success around the idea that you can wall off America, literally with the wall in some places, but that we can prevent terrorism by essentially doing old mitigation things, like doing more to keep them from happening, and that keeping out immigrants, keeping out Muslims. And that tension is very real. And as I say, it's not simply a kind of political propaganda, that it does play on people's fears. And fear of immigrants and fear of Islam is an important component of lots of people who are influenced by Trump.
We saw that in those early days and years after 9/11 with the Patriot Act, where people were willing to trade off, in many cases, personal liberties to get that feeling of safety. Clearly, none of these narratives is the one. But given the fact that we are where we are now, 15 years later, and looking at what those 15 years have wrought, what then becomes a realistic narrative for us in looking at this idea of, are we really safer, or how do we keep ourselves safer?
Well, I think that in my opinion, you have to move a little bit away from safety and ask, how can we make ourselves resilient? How can we make ourselves more resilient? And I don't want to make that sound insensitive, because it's going to mean that we're going to have to realize that two things. First of all, that there's going to be some terrible suffering and that we can recover from those suffering. That's not to take away the empathy and the sympathy we feel for others. The second thing is, as Karen Munger Ward points out, and I want to add, she's the editor of a libertarian magazine, and
Reason.
And she's got a very kind of interesting way of thinking about it, which isn't all that different from the others, but she's more clear. Sometimes you're going to have to understand that there are good reasons for not using money for anti-terrorist activity, because the world has other priorities. She uses the example of why a hospital won't spend a whole lot of money for more biohazard protection, because she says, look, they've got a lot of other things that they need to do, like another MRI. And trying to get people to see the world in terms of the choices and the risks that we have to face.
What it seems like, you know, she is saying, and what you've just, you know, reiterated, is that we're looking at this through the lens of cost benefit of an analysis. What money you're going to put that's going to get you, you know, the most important aspects of this, and not necessarily take away from others that might be even more important.
I think that's right. Cost benefit analysis always has a kind of sterile economic wonk notion to it, but I think in a sense that's how we live our lives anyway. We make those kind of decisions. What we often do in those kinds of decisions is to overemphasize the importance of some kind of risk. And it's understandable. It's psychologically built into us. In some ways, it's evolutionary. But I think what the other pieces, and to some extent Friedman are trying to get you, the Stephen Brill are trying to get you to think about, is that essentially we have to apply the same thing to terrorism, and we have to understand that these kinds of things are going to be part of our lives, and the important thing is to figure out how to recover from them, not so much to think that you can prevent them.
Or be driven by fear.
But to tell people you shouldn't be driven by fear is pretty hard. You have to do a whole series of things to demonstrate what positively you can do in situations like this and emphasize situations.
So just very briefly, doesn't this sort of harken back to that idea about nothing to fear but fear itself, if you really want to take it to that logical extension?
Well, I think that's right. But there are things to fear. You know, Roosevelt's speech, in context, he said a lot of other things that made that statement so powerful. There are other things to fear, some of which we can control, some of which we can't control. But the important thing may be to recover from the things that really are the worst case scenarios.
Neil Milner, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
Political scientist Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. And the article he was discussing, the Stephen Brill article from The Atlantic, is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It is 8:16 on the nose, and coming up, a knack for trivia pays off with a trip to Vegas. But first, your backyard quiz.
For longtime listeners of this program, today's backyard quiz just might be an easy one. We're thinking about a United States naval vessel that has a secure place in history and in Hawaii. It was built at Brooklyn's New York Navy Yard and launched on January 29, 1944, with Captain William M. Callahan in command. Its moment of glory came on September 2, 1945, in Tokyo Bay, when representatives of the Allied and Axis powers met on its deck to sign the agreement that ended the Second World War. As U.S. sailors and Marines stood at attention, representatives of the Empire of Japan were directed to step forward and sign the two copies of the Instrument of Surrender. General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in the Pacific, then signed on behalf of all the victorious powers, followed by representatives of Allied nations in attendance. MacArthur concluded the ceremony by saying, quote, "Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed." The historic battleship, with a modest plaque on the surrender deck, now lives at Pearl Harbor. And this morning, we're looking for its name. Come on, you guys. You know this one. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Be first, be fast, and you'll walk away with a T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Lena from Wanlua High School. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Quiz shows are addictive to watch them and to play them. And once a player gets hooked, he's hooked for life. It's safe to say that would describe Art Harris, proud member of Team Chucky, the winning team in the Oahu Island Trivia Tournament of Champions. His victory is taking him to Vegas. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Art.
Good morning, Chris.
And congratulations are clearly in order here.
Thanks. I think the Oahu Island thing is a little overblown, but yeah, it's you know, it's nice.
When people want to give you credit, if it's overblown, so what, right?
I guess I have to take it.
Yes, you do. What got you interested in playing trivia with a team?
Well, you know, there's been a bunch of casual stuff going on for maybe 8 years now. And, you know, it's one of those things where when you have a bunch of esoteric knowledge that's floating around your head, you need to find some outlet for it. And screaming at the TV when Jeopardy's going is just not sufficient after a while. So, you know, when I found out that these activities were going on around town, I said, oh, I'm interested. And a buddy of mine, Chuck, who our team is named after, Chuck Arkeel, he's a classmate of mine from high school, and said, hey, you know, why don't you come and join us? And, you know, we started doing it from there, and it kind of blossomed.
So what happens in a trivia contest? You're all sitting there with, what, like buzzers in front of you?
Or? Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because it started off that way. We had this guy that just had this huge setup. I mean, he had wires, cables, lights, buzzers, everything. And, you know, it was like a radio studio here with the wires everywhere. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, we started with that, and it was just for fun. You know, there were no prizes. It was just for the glory. And we did it for a while, and all of a sudden it started to pick up, and Manifest down on Hotel Street, the bar down there, started holding a weekly trivia night that was based on a trivia company that was nationwide called Stump Trivia. And, you know, so we were going there every week, and then they all of a sudden they had a championship back in 2011, and our team won. So, you know, we're kind of hooked. You know, we won the first championship.
Sure.
And, you know, well, we haven't won between then and this year, so we've had a dry spell, but you know we do it for fun. We do it because we enjoy playing.
So your team all sits there, and then a question comes up on a board, or
the host reads the question. The teams are up to six players, so you can have, you know, one if you're a genius, but generally the winning teams have between four and six.
Yeah.
He reads the question. They announce all the categories first, then they read the question, and you have to basically bet points. Yeah, so in the first round, there's 1, 3, 5, 7. Second round, 2, 4, 6, 8, so on and so forth. And if you get it right, you get the points. If you don't get it right, you're not penalized generally. And at the end of the night, whoever has the most points.
So you hear a category, and you say, "Okay, U.S. presidents, I'm going to bet 8 or whatever." And, of course, you bet based on the category, but you obviously haven't heard the question yet.
Actually, it's even easier than that, because you don't even have to bet until after you hear the question.
Oh, really?
So, you know, you have to kind of strategize, because you want to save your higher points for the categories that you are familiar with.
Sure.
And, you know,
sure,
go with the lower points for the ones that you don't. But, you know, we have our ringer, Dave Milks, who's a teacher at Castle. He's his favorite category, he tells us, is vice presidential wives.
Which most people would not be able to name a single one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that does speak to a level of nerdosity, doesn't it?
Yeah. The nerd testosterone runs high, yes.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So you obviously want like-minded nerds to be on your team.
Yeah, well, for us, we have a group of between 8 and 10 that kind of filter in and out. The mainstays are Chuck and Dave, who are hardcore, and they're there for virtually every one of the events. But the rest of us kind of float in and out. And, you know, I've been playing steadily for the last, I think, 4 months or so. But we have others that come in, go out. And, you know, because we're having fun. We you know, it's people we want to spend the night with, and, you know, sitting at a table and, you know, chiding each other over the wrong answer from the round before, that kind of
thing.
So, you know.
I would figure that each of you has areas of strength and weakness. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, are you the history guy, or...
I'm the really, really weird knowledge guy, if you ask me. They usually say, oh, you know, if there's a technology or a computer one, oh, that's art. He's going to know that. Uh-huh. But then it turns out to be something. I remember once the category was, you know, technology or something, and it was text acronyms. And I'm like, I don't know any of the text acronyms. You know, I mean, I know LOL and I know ROFL and a few others. But, you know, beyond that, right. I'm clueless. Right. So my thing is pulling just stuff out of the air. Let me tell you. Like, oh, yeah, you know, I remember that movie. Or, oh yeah, I saw the title of that book in the library, not having read that many books in my life. So,
well, then there's that thing where even if you are kind of a polymath and knows a bunch of different things, you could get suddenly hit with a category like, you know, hip-hop artists.
Absolutely.
And be completely useless in that category.
Yeah, that would be where we're completely useless. Most of the games have a picture-bound component where they'll give you 10 pictures and you have to identify the 10 hip-hop artists or something like that. And, you know, I was telling you earlier, I keep sliding it into the host. I go, yeah, I really want that one that has 10 guitars from the 1970s and tell me who plays them. That I could do, you know.
Yeah, I could probably do that one pretty well. But, you know, inevitably, you could sort of step into this huge black hole just when you're doing great, couldn't you?
Absolutely. In the 3 weeks prior to this championship, our team was first place going to the final round. Those questions came out, and we had absolutely no clue what the answers were, and we ended up placing second or third.
That's a scary, it's a cautionary tale for just about anyone, well, isn't it?
It is, except, you know, as I said, we really go there to have fun. And yes, we would like to win, but when we don't, it's not a huge blow.
That's probably a good philosophy for us to carry through life, Art.
We try.
Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Good talking to you. Art Harris and the fellow members of Team Chucky are the winners of the Oahu Island Trivia Tournament of Championships. Their prize is a Las Vegas vacation for each one of them. You can find out more about our Hawaii Conversation on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
A report on preventing bullying of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in America was released this month by a White House task force. The experiences chronicled in it come from surveys of 30 organizations. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We talked about 30 organizations, 30 groups. What were those groups who were surveyed, and what were the questions that were asked?
A variety of organizations, including student and youth groups, domestic violence centers, LGBT advocates, and so forth. And I should also add, the White House conducted listening sessions in 29 cities across the country, including New York and Los Angeles and Chicago. And it was not a data-gathering survey. It was more to find out what the experiences were of Asian American and Pacific Islanders in schools. And what they heard was very disturbing. Things like students being told to go back to their country, being mocked for their facial features or their skin color, the style of dress, even the food they bring to school from home. A recent immigrant being told, you know, you're too Asian. Even teachers playing into these stereotypes and perpetuating this hostile environment. So really a very disturbing look coming from the White House.
And this is across the United States. In Hawaii, we often mythologize about how much aloha we have for newcomers or how much we really have. And much of that seems to be a function of who those newcomers are. So what did this report show in terms of Hawaii compared to the rest of the country?
Hawaii was not surveyed by the White House, but the White House report did note where the highest concentrations of Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, they use the acronym AAPI, where they're located. And of course, that includes us, along with the West Coast and the Northeast part of the country. But the Hawaii Department of Education's own statistics on bullying and harassment very much parallel, really dovetail with what the White House said. I'm just going to give you a few stats. 19% of Native Hawaiians, 17% of Filipinos in high school, this is a 2015 statistic, said they had been bullied. Those numbers more than double when you look at middle schools, mm-hmm. and more than 60% of those same groups saying that bullying and harassment is a very serious problem. So this is coming from our own students.
Was it at all, you know, odd to you that given the fact that we have such a high concentration of Asian Americans and Pacific Island residents that we weren't surveyed?
It actually, the reason I looked into the report is because I saw the word Micronesian and Native Hawaiian in a blurb for the report. I thought, they had to have come to Hawaii. In fact, they did not. But as you know, there are many Micronesians and Native Hawaiians that live on the mainland. So I think it's fair to say that that our experiences are similar to what's going on the mainland. But yes, I think we should have been included.
And finally, just looking at how the DOE is handling this relative to, you know, some of the stories that you've covered. How well are we really treating Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders?
The DOE has a pretty extensive program, services, a policy towards dealing with this. It includes things like empowering students themselves to help support each other, having networks where they can go and feel like they can talk and be in a safe place, educating teachers, even having interpreters and so forth. A number of different initiatives that the DOE thinks is essential, but it's a work in progress.
As is many a thing that you cover. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethann.
Every day, Chad Blair joins us from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Hi, good morning. I'm Bree Bumatai from Manoa Valley Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lahm and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, I guess I have to learn a new acronym, huh?
Well, you know, we've talked about STEM a lot, science, technology, engineering, and math, and we are encountering the addition of art in there to make it STEAM, and it sort of piqued my interest to find out what's going on with some of the, let's say, some of these scientific organizations, like we invited Schmidt Ocean Institute and the National Parks Arts Foundation to join us, as well as a couple of artists, to talk about the artists in residence and explore sort of this intersection between art and science.
Well, there's plenty of intersection. I mean, look at Leonardo, right? I mean, there's plenty of people who might say it's about time.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, there's a whole, let's say, industry out there for science illustration and science, illustrators. They have a very keen eye on the natural and physical world. And sometimes we lose some of that connection when we just talk about the science. So can artists help us communicate better in terms of, let's say, some of the things that affect humans in their feelings or their relationship with perhaps nature? And I think artists have that ability to, you know, bring something out that we may not necessarily see if we're just talking pure science.
That's what they're supposed to do anyway.
Yeah, so, you know, we'll have them on, we'll talk about it and explore sort of this intersection. I think it's an exciting topic, so we wanted to have, you know, the panel on today.
Sounds great, Bert. Thanks.
Yep.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Hawaii is one of 23 states with mandatory ignition interlock provisions for drunk driving offenses. That law came in 2011, and since then, drunk driving has dropped by 23%, according to Mothers Against Drunk Driving Hawaii. Still, Matt Hawaii would like to see lawmakers improve the current law, allowing for no-refusal activities. To explain what those are, give us a look at brand new statistics and how the national five-year MAD strategic plan begun last year is influencing MAD Hawaii's crafting of their 2017 legislative agenda. Chapter founder and 32-year volunteer Carol McNamee joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you.
It's always good to talk to you as well.
Looking at sort of, you know, the overview of how all states have been handling drunk driving, it seems, you know, Hawaii has been doing rather well of late.
Actually, I'm very excited because we just got latest statistics about our local situation with drunk driving, and we only had, well, actually this is for all traffic fatalities, but Hawaii only had 94. Now I say only, that I shouldn't even use that word. We had 94 traffic fatalities in 2015, but this is the lowest number that I can ever remember. Back in 1990, we had 177 fatalities. So we've decreased that number by 47%, and that is really good news. And, of course, that does also include a reduction in our alcohol-related fatalities. We used to have at least 45, 50, 60 per year, and this last year, 2015, we had 36. So that's only 38% of the total fatalities. Again, I hate to say only, but it does show improvement, but we don't want any fatalities, and especially those that are alcohol-related, where we know we can do something about the problem.
Carol,
so we're going to keep working to get that number lower and lower.
I want to talk to you a little bit about that because, you know, many of us remember the campaigns that MAD ran here in Hawaii, and some of this that now, you know, might be coming back in the form of these better statistics. Is there another plan to be able to change the focus of the campaign in Hawaii apropos to the way the national agenda has its five-year strategic plan that began last year?
I don't think that we're going to totally change the focus. What we have found, and of course what our national organization has found, is that interlocks work. The ignition interlock, just to remind the listeners, is like an in-car breathalyzer, and it's wired into the ignition system, and an arrested driver who wants to keep driving legally uses this system, blows into it as he's beginning to start the car, and if he has any presence of alcohol in his system, the car won't start. And so we have found, as I said, that this really works because last year there were 13,418 instances where a person with alcohol in his or her system was prevented from starting the vehicle and getting on the road, which, of course, for you and me and all your listeners, means that the roads were so much safer. And I believe that this interlock system has helped reduce the fatalities that we have just talked about in our last few years, since 2011 when the law went into effect.
So as MAD National is looking at, you know, it has listed, you know, four directions for its strategic plan for the next 4 years that it will be working within this five-year period, that seems to be building more capacity to be able to do more outreach, all of that. But it seems that Hawaii's chapter of MAD is narrowly focusing on the ignition interlock and being able to make that law even more extensive by adding the idea of no refusal activities. What are those activities?
I'm not going to talk about the no refusal idea. That is something that I think will be taken up by the impaired driving task force, and we really haven't gotten into that subject at any great length, Beth Ann, so I think it's premature. I know it may be discussed, but at this point, that's really premature.
But people don't even understand, you know, kind of what those are. Can you give that some shape? When they read this on the website, when they hear discussions about it, what's a no-refusal activity?
Well, you know, in our state and in most states, you are allowed to refuse taking the breath test or blood test, but of course you pay a price for that because you are going to have a much longer revocation period. Your license will be taken away twice as long for refusing as it would be if you took the test, one of the tests, and failed. But now some states are saying, well, we're not going to allow you to refuse at all, and so they're going to have you take the test, and if you don't want to take the test, I guess they're looking at getting a system of a search warrant so that they can actually have a blood test, have blood drawn with a search warrant that they've set up with a judge who will issue that warrant. But as I said, this really has not been discussed at any length yet in Hawaii. It may be on the agenda of the task force coming up, but I don't know how serious we will be about that issue.
So as you look at the coming session and wanting to see an improvement to the current Interlock law, is there something more just within in the law itself as it has been now in existence for the last 5 years that you'd like to see changed?
Yes, absolutely. As I said, we're seeing that Interlock really works, but the problem is that although we have 6,000 to 7,000 DUI arrests per year, which means a lot of potential for Interlock, only 1 in 5 offenders are now getting that Interlock. So we want to have an alternative for those people who do not get the Interlock to make them accountable. Because unfortunately, we have to say that we know there are going to be those people who choose to drive illegally. And we're concerned about that. That's a very high-risk group. So if we can get a system to also have those people be accountable, that would be something we'd like to do. It may involve having some kind of a probation system, which we do not have now, and I think we're one of only a few states that don't have probation, and maybe we're the only one. And we'd have to do it on a minimal level. But we're very interested in and excited about a new system, a new device that has come out from our same company that provides the Interlock, and this is where they can just test for alcohol in a little device that looks like a cell phone, and it's cellular technology. And so if you don't get an Interlock, maybe the alternative is that you're told don't drink at all, and you're going to be tested from time to time by having to blow into this separate device. So I think we will be looking at that, as well as trying to strengthen our statutes that relate to driving while revoked. So for those people who have had their license revoked because of a DUI and they're still driving, if they are caught for that, we'd like to see stronger measures for addressing those people.
Carol McNamee, thank you very much for the time this morning. We will be looking for that agenda as it continues to develop before the next legislative session.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Carol McNamee founded the Hawaii chapter of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, in 1984 and was its first president. For 32 years, she's been involved with public policy issues and fundraising, and for 7 years served on the national board. We'll have the link to MAD Hawaii on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. Thank you.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
you want. I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. What is it that sparks us to help others when we'll receive no personal benefit? It's known that we're rewarded with the release of dopamine when we do things that make us happy, but what's going on when our actions have no direct benefit to us? It must be something else. The science of epigenetics may shed some light on this, for researchers now believe that a gene called COMT influences which neurotransmitters are activated in our brain. People with certain mutations of this gene have proven to be more altruistic than those without the mutation. There's evolutionary evidence suggesting early human groups with the mutation were more generous and had a better standard of living than groups without it. Therefore, they were more likely to survive adversity. It may be that a lifeguard who swims through heavy surf, risking everything to rescue someone in Waimea Bay, might have the COMT gene mutation. It's another answer to the question, why do people help each other? Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we thought about a battleship that has become a symbol of the Allied victory in the Second World War in the Pacific. It was commissioned on June 11, 1944, with Captain William M. Callahan in command, and decommissioned for the last time on March 31, 1992, making her the last active service battleship in the world. Along the way, she saw service from the Second World War as the site of the Japanese surrender to Operation Desert Storm, where she patrolled in the Persian Gulf. After Desert Storm, the ship passed through Hawaii on its way to a berth at Long Beach Naval Station, but was not destined to remain there. After a dedicated effort by the local community, the Battleship Missouri returned to service as centerpiece of the Battleship Missouri Memorial in Pearl Harbor. That was on January 29, 1999.
And Daryl Itau called us from Aiea, and he was at the Arizona Memorial looking across at the memorial. And thank you very much for knowing the answer. You are going to get our T-shirt. Now, if you've got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And while we're giving people thanks, want to let you know that for the fourth year in a row, Hawaii Public Radio has been recognized with 4 stars by the nation's largest charity evaluator. Charity Navigator's top rating means that you can have confidence that your donation will be used efficiently and responsibly. And we thank these members who have recently shown us their trust and support. Sue Ann Wargo of Honolulu, Susan Jubiltera of Kapa'a, and Nell Mitchell of Makawao. You can find a link to our Charity Navigator rating at hawaiipublicradio.org, and we'll be happy to answer your questions if you call us during regular business hours at 955-8821. And thanks.
Western science has a troubling history of ignoring the accumulated knowledge of indigenous people around the world. As Western powers colonized far-off corners of the world, their scientists often ignored or simply failed to ask what the people who lived there already knew about the natural world around them. Gary Paul Nabon is an ethnobiologist whose mission it is to remedy an imbalance that has denied us priceless knowledge. He's on his way to Maui for a talk, and I spoke with him yesterday.
An ethnobiologist is someone who tries to understand, appreciate, and celebrate the knowledge within indigenous cultures of the natural world, whether it's plants, animals, microbes, or landscapes. And that doesn't necessarily have to be vetted or confirmed by Western science. In other words, we appreciate the creative tension between different kinds of knowledge rather than feeling that if Western science says one thing and indigenous science says the other, then indigenous science is wrong. We're really talking about cross-cultural science and the interactions between people who are interested in plants or animals from various cultural perspectives.
Wouldn't you think, Gary, that when Western science, quote, discovers a new place or new people, that they would sort of want to know what they knew?
And that's what some of the best explorers did, but that was few and far between. That I'm humbled whenever I go to a place that I'm not familiar with, how much I have to learn about it. And certainly there were people that had that kind of empathy, whether they were Chinese navigators or European or even African and island people. But we still have that problem that most of what's been written up is this notion that the invaders inevitably improved or negated what went before them. And both of those are faulty assumptions.
and the invaders, discoverers, whatever you want to call them, have clearly ignored a great deal of found knowledge that was right there in front of them.
That's right. So we've not only colonized lands, we've colonized the notion of science that does not appreciate other kinds of indigenous science that are equally astute in their observations about the natural world. And so we've lost a lot of knowledge that's complementary to what we have in scientific journals that's just as important.
You would think it would be very unscientific to ignore any source of knowledge, wouldn't you?
Well, it's in part a linguistic problem that we scientists sometimes recorded names, for example, for plants and their pollinators that completely indicated a local understanding of the interactions between plants and animals in a very detailed way, but because the explorers or colonizers or invaders did not know the indigenous language, a lot of the nuances of that knowledge was lost. They just used the name but didn't understand the depth of the stories and the observations that were embedded in that name. So it was not all intentional. It was naivety, ignorance, and unfamiliarity rather than mean-spiritedness sometimes that kept people from fully understanding these things.
But, it's clear that there's a lot of assumptions built into really, I suppose you'd say, Western thought, that it's, you know, the scientific method as devised in the West is the only way to arrive at verifiable truth.
And what's ironic about that is that now more than any other point in human history, we need to not understand but perhaps acknowledge and mobilize the insights in these other forms of science that can tell us in depth about parts of the natural world and how it's changing. And so in relation to climate change, indigenous fishermen in the Hawaiian Islands, in the Sea of Cortez or Gulf of California where I work, know far more about the pace and the nature of climate change and how it's affecting oceans and coastlines than most scientists, because they're out there every day observing it, and they have embedded in their oral traditions hundreds of years of observations by their ancestors. So we're losing out in a double way. We don't acknowledge and respect the current practitioners who are out there making observations that may be of value not just to science but to our survival. And we've ignored or dismissed the fact that they have encoded knowledge about decades and centuries of natural phenomena and behaviors of animals and plants that most scientists still don't have access to. So I'm humbled by how much there is to learn and celebrate in indigenous science. And the native Hawaiian knowledge of not just the islands, but the seas around them, I think is one of the most stunning examples of this, and that native Hawaiian terms like ahoihoi and a'a and kapuka have come into the scientific vocabulary are sort of used as classic examples that indigenous people understood things that the rest of us need to understand as well.
Gary Paul Nabon will speak in the Green Room, the Merwin Conservancy's Environmental and Literary Salon, this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the McCoy Studio Theater. Ethnobiology, fusing Western science with the accumulated knowledge of people who actually live in an area, seems a long overdue discipline.
Well, one that's been around for quite a while, but maybe we're just paying a little bit more attention to right now. But when you talk to long-time, not just gardeners, but people who have been studying botany for such a long time, they will tell you that so much is derived from indigenous cultures.
Sure.
That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. Now, you've no doubt heard about NOAA's newly proposed rules concerning Hawaiian spinner dolphins. We're going to talk with the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Protected Resources Division of NOAA, Fisheries Pacific Island Regional Office. That's a mouthful. That'll just say that Ann Garrett would be here tomorrow.
And we'll look at what it takes to care for and feed a community garden. We'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217.
And if you've missed any part of the show, want to hear something again, or to look up any of the guests or topics, all of that can be found on the conversation page on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and we'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.